Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
Well, everyone, it is the top of the hour, and I'm really excited to see so many people here at the top of the hour. We have a very important and great session that I'm looking forward to having this conversation with Kim Smoke. So we want to start, as usual, reviewing some of the state of the state items, you know, that we are seeing, in particular the numbers that we're seeing in some of the projections. So the first slide I want to go to is some information that came from Johns Hopkins. If you advance to that, this is where we're at globally, you know, over 13 million cases globally. And on the next slide, this is a highlight of where we're at in the United States. And I don't think it's unfamiliar to anyone, especially if you've been on the calls, but even if you're just watching the news, that we are seeing surges in some parts of the country, especially down in South Florida where I sit at. If we advance to the next slide, this is just some of the projections that we've been seeing. You know, there's been a lot of updates, and this information really is impacted by what we're doing with social distancing, what we're doing around masking. So, you know, currently you can see that the projection shows that if we keep with the way we're going, you know, we're probably gonna see more infectious and more cases test positive. If you go to the next slide, this is really showing hospital resources. And again, this is for the entire United States. So as of today, we're seeing an increased utilization in resources again because of where we're at in the country. And there's a lot of variability. It all depends on what we see around reopening and orders for masking and those type of things. But where we're going to really focus in on is, if you go to the next slide, is in Florida. Currently, we're over 300,000 cases now, and anyone who's seen any type of reporting from the news would know that we're seeing a surge really in Miami, Dade, and Broward, in the Palm Beach, which is the South Florida area, but it is impacting the entire state. So we've seen these numbers escalate, and we're all aware of that. So what we really want to do today, and we have the great opportunity, and I want to get into this right away because we have a lot of questions for Kim, is to discuss how these challenges, how the surge is impacting our facilities, and the challenges that we are seeing around this. And I'm going to turn the mic over to Kim so that she can introduce herself to the group. She may not need an introduction, but just in case.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this is Kim Smoke. I'm the Chief of Field Operations here. I'm the State Survey Agency Director for the state of Florida. And just like many of you, been working nonstop since the public health emergency was declared. And first of all, I just want to say that, you know, and you, this goes without saying probably, but, you know, it's an unprecedented time that we're in. And hopefully we'll get to the end of this, just like we do with a lot of our other disasters, but, you know, always appreciate the medical director's support in our healthcare facilities and anything that, you know, you can do from a clinical standpoint and just being available. And I think that's been the most helpful for us, is that whenever there's something that comes up, I always mention to the Secretary Mayhew and Deputy Secretary McKinstry, well, you know what, we have a great resource in the Florida Medical Director Association. So just wanted to share that and continue to thank you for your support as we work through these continued issues and struggling times here in the state of Florida.
So Kim, if we could start around metrics, you know, I would love to know where we're at and what that looks like in comparison to some other areas and where CMS is focusing in on when it comes to metrics.
Okay. Well, I will tell you the biggest metric, and I think you showed, you know, how we're comparing, you know, in the United States and, you know, nationally, and how we compare, you know, to Florida through the Johns Hopkins website. There's a lot of other websites out there, and I'll just give you honestly some real numbers. And this is, you know, specific to the state of Florida, and a breakdown of our nursing homes and assisted living facilities when it comes to our current cases. As of yesterday, we had, as far as positive test results for residents in our nursing homes and assisted living facilities, we had 3,522, and that's our residents. And that is a positivity rate of 2.48%. For staff, as of yesterday as well, we had over 6,192 staff that had tested positive that work in our nursing homes and assisted living facilities for a positivity rate of 3.16%. Since there is such a focus on nursing homes, as you know, through the CDC and NSHN reporting, I've asked some of our data team if they could pull me separate matrix out for our nursing homes. And as of yesterday, our nursing homes, out of that 3,000 that I mentioned earlier for nursing homes and assisted living facilities, 2,704 of those residents were nursing home residents for a positivity rate of 4.20%. And staff in our nursing homes is 4,260, so for a positivity rate of 3.60. And you're right, there is a high focus, an extreme focus, I will say, on nursing homes, specifically in the state of Florida, because CMS has designated Florida now as a hotspot because of our increase in cases. And as you mentioned, down in our South Florida area, Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach area, are definitely hot spots, and I think it probably stayed pretty much hot spots throughout this whole time. Our Pinellas, Polk, Hillsborough area, Lee, Charlotte, those are also now becoming hot spots, and we have a lot of day-to-day interaction with our county health departments in those areas. But CMS is very interested, and they want to put it and see, as CMS has said it to me this morning, they are looking to put some boots on the ground here in Florida with CMS and CDC, and not really from a regulatory perspective, but more from a, how can we come in and help you guys in Florida? So that is something that is coming. So, and that's hot off the presses. I just had some calls this morning with CMS regarding what they want to do coming into the state of Florida.
That's good to know. Keith, when you get a positive, a person, a staff member who's positive at a facility, what are the reporting requirements? How do we share that?
Well, the facility definitely should be contacting the Department of Health. So if they do have a staff member that comes back positive, they should be contacting the Department of Health. And also reporting that in the emergency status system, which is our state's database. As you know, right now we have the emergency rule for testing of staff. So that it through Curative is the vendor that is doing all the staff testing. That is in their web portal. So we are able to pull some metrics out of that portal for some data. And I can share with you, I do have some data as of yesterday's reporting of the number of staff that have been tested.
Yeah, so as a, great. How many do we know the number of staff?
What I can provide is that, and this is in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. This is not broken down by provider type, so just keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. So as of yesterday, over 139,869 tests have been completed. 110,217 test results had been provided. And out of that, 3,033 positive samples for nursing home and ALF staff have been reported. And that's just as of yesterday. Also, there's been some shipping debacles with UPS has been main company they've used for shipping. And as of yesterday, there were about 38 nursing homes and ALFs in combination that reported not receiving their test kits. So late yesterday afternoon, Curative sent another batch to those 38 facilities that identified they hadn't received their test kits. So that is something that we've worked through from the start. So that's a little bit of snippet of information of the testing matrix that we're doing.
Yeah, you're really reading my mind, because I was going to ask about the emergency rules. So let's just stay here for 1 second.
Sure.
I really was interested in knowing how that evolved. You know, when we saw it come through, there were some providers who recommended testing more frequently. And I know from certain entities, we are seeing that, you know, some of the colleges are saying, well, maybe we should test every week. How did we settle in on every 2 weeks?
Well, Governor Ron DeSantis, I think, initially had stated in press conferences this morning, staff tested, and the 2 weeks was an original thought. And I think that we were moving forward with the emergency rule for 2 weeks. And then, you know, naturally all the other recommendations are to test weekly. But at that point, we had already proceeded with publishing the 2 week standard. I do not know if we're going to change that. You know, an emergency rule is good for 90 days. So this emergency rule was effective, you know, June, end of June. So it's good for, you know, it's in effect for 90 days. Now, during that 90 day period of time, that rule could be fully adopted, or in 90 days, it just expires. Not sure that, I mean, that's definitely a governor's office working with Secretary Mayhew, what we would do, you know, if anything would be, you know, fully adopted. But that's kind of how that 2 weeks came up. And I think, you know, we've all read a lot that says, you know, weekly tests, as a matter of fact, that's what CMS has asked, and the nursing homes that we spoke to today, CMS specifically asked about, you know, well, how often are you testing your residents and staff? Are you doing it weekly? But with the staff, you know, there is that rule for every 2 weeks. And I think that was just something initially to go with, and figuring out, you know, the number of staff we would have to test. So that's really all I know on that. Are things going to change with the testing? I'm not sure. And things change, I think you guys know, sometimes on a day-to-day basis. So just always be prepared.
Yeah, I would imagine. And I think we're living through that rapid change.
Absolutely.
When a facility has a staff member test positive, or even residents test positive, what is the responsibility of the facility to report that to other residents or families? How are we handling that?
Yeah, as you know, CMS published a new regulatory requirement for reporting. When there is positive staff and residents in a nursing home. That is a new requirement for us to look at, and they do have to notify our other residents, our residents representatives in the nursing home. Now, I will say this, from the start, in early March, when we started seeing test results come back positive for other residents, a lot of our nursing homes were way out in front of this, and had already, I'd heard from nursing homes who said, you know, we created a Facebook page or an Instagram account and had their families, or they had mass emails that went out to family members and residents. I've only received very few complaints from family members who in nursing homes who have come back and said, well, nobody told us that, you know, there was a staff member or a resident that tested positive on my mother's wing or unit. And that's from the start. That was, we had received like some of those complaints initially on, but not anymore. I mean, and I think that facilities are and have done a good job about communicating with family members and other residents when there is a positive case in their facility. The other thing that, nursing home or ALF needs to make sure that they're doing is updating every day by 10 a.m. in our emergency status system. We use the emergency status system for reporting data. That data is shared, you know, at the request of Department of Health, who is in charge during our public health emergency. So reporting their cases timely in the emergency status system is very critical. We actually have a regulatory requirement for them to update during the time of an emergency into the agency's electronic emergency system. So it is our emergency status system. So it's very important that these facilities update this timely. And it's also important that they update this timely for us to capture the number of test kits. And that's how we've been using emergency status system, is we just didn't call nursing homes and say, well, how many staff do you have? So we've pulled that to, you know, pull that information from our emergency status system as well. And, you know, the definition of staff for the emergency rule is very broad. It includes, you know, contractors, home health agencies, hospice staff that come in. You know, that's why we have seen some of our requests for testing kits have kicked up for the number that per facility that they want, because, you know, everybody's understanding to make sure to account for all those extra employees as well.
And it's been my understanding now that if, let's say for physicians and physician assistants and nurse practitioners who may go to multiple facilities, if they test that one, can they share their results with another?
Absolutely, they can share their results with another facility.
What about for the assisted living facilities? Are we following the same guidance that we're laying out for the nursing facilities?
When it comes to the emergency rule for tests for staff testing, absolutely. There was an emergency rule for nursing homes and an emergency rule for ALF. So that's 429 is assisted living facility licensure rule that we did an emergency rule for, and then chapter 400 part two is the nursing home. So the language is the same in both. One just says nursing home and one just says assisted living facility. So those are, it is the same requirement in our assisted living facilities.
Okay.
And I will say it's the curative test, and it is it's the mouth swab test, you know, where you swab your both sides of your cheeks, upper and lower gums, under your tongue, on top of your tongue, and your roof through your mouth. And I've done this test three times. I'll do it again Thursday when I go to the state EOC. It's very simple, easy test. I don't know if any of you have done this test as well. It's definitely different than the nasal swab test. I had that one time, and although it wasn't that uncomfortable, it's not something I'd want to do every day. But it's a very easy, simple test to do with the mouth swab.
Yeah, anything is better than that nasopharyngeal swab to your brain. I was wondering, when it comes to looking at our approach to testing for the nursing home residents and assisted living facility residents, you know, I think early in our efforts, we saw the state send out the National Guard. Where are we at now with requirements around testing residents?
I think that there's still some debate on doing emergency rules for testing residents. We did do an emergency rule early on, April or May, I believe it was, that included, you know, testing residents and staff, and for facilities to allow Department of Health in to do the testing and to also complete infection control assessments as well. Department of Health was already doing that, but they were getting a little bit of resistance, more from our assisted living facilities, because I think they just didn't understand. So that's why we did that rule. Now, I will say that, you know, nursing home residents and even ALF residents, they have a right to refuse the testing. And I know early on, there were very few residents in our nursing homes, specifically in our nursing homes and ALFs, that actually refused to be tested. I mean, and it was very early on. And I think part of it was, I mean, you mentioned, Dr. Cicada, the bringing in the National Guard. And I think that, you know, that was a governor's initiative. He said, bring in the National Guard. We're going to do all this testing. And while that was a good idea, the plan just didn't iron out, I think, because National Guard, you know, National Guard's good if you know guarding something. They're used to toting guns, not testing swabs. And I think a portion of the National Guard that was being used maybe just didn't feel very comfortable doing the testing. So we had a lot of problems in the beginning with some problems with the testing kits that were done, and having to retest a lot of residents and staff, and especially the residents were like, wait a minute, I've just had this test. So there is a lot of discussion about, you know, mandating and how that would work in Florida for resident testing. I know that is in CMS's guidelines that has come out about resident testing. So I think that we're trying to figure that out. And I don't know if you're aware, but CMS did release yesterday. They did a press release, and more information is to come on that, which, because it just came out yesterday evening, like 4 or 5 o'clock, that CMS has a point of care device. And I do not know the point of care device off the top of my head right now. I read the articles last night that they are sending to nursing homes in hotspots in throughout the United States. So that will be a point of care device that will be used for resident and staff testing. And I know more to come on that.
Now, if we are rounding in the facilities, the clinical providers, medical directors, if we're out there rounding and we order someone to have a COVID-19 test and we get pushback, what should we do? How should we handle those situations?
Who would like getting pushback from the facility or from the...
We've had a couple of comments come in where there may have been pushback at the facility level. And I don't know if any of the DONs on the call have any insight to that, but I'm just curious, what do you do in those situations, or what would you advise?
Well, I would just maybe some education to the staff that's giving you pushback. I'm assuming it may be administration that's pushing back. I don't know why. Other than they may not, they may be concerned with their numbers going up, but I don't think now is the time to worry about your numbers going up. I think now is the time we need to worry about our residents. But that, to me, that would be the only reason I think that I would see administration in a facility wanting to push back on, you know, you ordering one of your residents to be tested, especially if the resident or the resident's family is asking for that test, then the facility should allow that to happen.
Okay. I wanted to go back to the dedicated COVID facilities. Sure. I wanted to just get your insight on how we evolve to this point. I think so many months ago, mm-hmm. back in April, we talked about having dedicated facilities. And since then, we've seen some nursing facilities successfully open up their own isolation units. So if you could just tell us how we evolved to the point of having those dedicated facilities throughout Florida.
Sure. Well, you know, one thing that because of our population in Florida and the number of nursing homes that we had in Florida, we were concerned early on about facilities and about some nursing homes not having the ability to set up dedicated wings or units in their individual facility. And what we wanted to avoid is, you know, mass exited from nursing homes into hospitals, what we're seeing now. I know that we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, transferring to hospitals. So our Secretary Mayhew was like, you know what, we really need to designate some facilities. So it started with Dolphin Point, and Dolphin Point is over in Jacksonville and Duval County. And they're a clear choice building. And they were actually in the process of opening this facility. And as soon as we had some positive cases throughout the state, and, you know, I think everybody was projecting us to hit high numbers early on. And so we wanted to go ahead aggressively and get those set up. So Dolphin Point, it was their first one. and it's the whole facility, and it's 146 beds that is totally dedicated to COVID positive patients. Actually, Governor DeSantis has done a press conference there. They've been visited by the vice president, as well as I think the secretary of HHS. So that's how that evolved kind of early on. And I'll tell you, since they were a new facility, they were not even licensed and certified yet. So we had to run out and do the surveys to get them certified in order for this to work. They also have worked with our Medicaid folks. And they do have an enhanced Medicaid rate in order to take care of our COVID positive patients. So Dolphin Point was the first one. And now we have 16 facilities in the state of Florida that are either their full facility is designated, and actually Dolphin Point, Oak Bridge down in Polk County, and also Inspire, Lauder Hill, and then Miami Care Center that, you know, just opened July 1st. Those are our full facilities that they're 100% of their beds are dedicated to COVID positive patients. And then the remaining facilities have wings or units between numbers of 22 beds units to up to 50 and 60 bed units that they have dedicated for COVID positive patients. And these facilities actually have an agreement with the agency. And so that's why we put this out on our agency's website. And if you guys don't have it, Ian, I'll be happy to send it to you and send you the link, because this changes almost every day, especially now. We actually have, just to give you an idea, I think we have about 8 facilities throughout the state, more in our Central and South Florida areas now that we have pending contracts with that we're trying to finalize those to get those out. That will also be, whether it's a unit or a wing or a whole facility dedicated to COVID positive patients. And I think we were one of the few states early on, you know, because we opened this first one at Dolphin Point early April. So we were one of the first states early on to say, you know what, this is what we need to do. Knowing our population in Florida and the number of nursing homes.
Delivering true excellence in post-acute medicine requires more investment, resources, and infrastructure than ever before. U.S. Post-Acute Care, a physician-led practice group, has built a business model dedicated to providing high-quality post-acute patient care on a national scale. We make it easy and beneficial for regional practices to leverage our resources to drive the growth and quality of their practices. Visit our website at uspostacutecare.com to see for yourself. Together, we'll be stronger.
So let me ask, first, whenever we designate one of those facilities, are they all then wrapped into that enhanced Medicaid daily rate?
They are. Whether it's a whole facility or a wing or a unit of facility, there is an enhanced Medicaid rate for COVID positive patients. And that's why we I talk to these facilities probably almost daily, and they have to report to us the number of vacant beds they've got. I have worked out with them and contacting hospitals for them to take admissions. It's not an easy job to do because it's 24/7 for them. They're every day they are admitting a high number of patients, which, you know, historically you wouldn't see 10, 15 admissions into a nursing home a day, but that's not the case in these designated facilities. It's tough, and they are reviewing. I know in speaking to the folks that are running Oak Ridge down in Polk County, I know that she looks at their admissions staff looks at 50 to 60 referrals a day. Miami Care Center, they opened July 1st. Before July 1st, they had received over 100 referrals from the local hospitals in that area. So it's not an easy task. So that's why the secretary really wanted to look to give some sort of Medicaid enhancement So that facilities would want to take this on. Plus you have to keep in mind, they're having to hire staff and they're having to pay staff at an increased rate in mm-hmm. order to get the staff dedicated to taking care of our COVID positive residents.
Now for transition purposes, if a person is at a facility and they test positive and they do not have an isolation unit, could they directly go to a COVID 19 dedicated facility?
Absolutely, and thank you for bringing that up, because one of the things, and we need your help as medical directors with this, one of the things that we are seeing now is a lot of nursing homes and even ALFs, as soon as a person is test positive and they're asymptomatic and there's absolutely no reason to send them to the hospital, they do not need hospital level of care. What we're seeing is just a lot of nursing homes and ALFs calling 911 and evacuating them out to the hospital. So we're seeing just our hospitals now are backed up and we're trying to decompress the hospitals. So absolutely, you can do a facility to facility transfer. If that person doesn't need that hospital level of care, we've got to keep them out of the hospital, because we also know there are other negative implications to residents being in our hospitals, which is hospital acquired infections. They could be in these hospitals. There's a reason for them to be there if they don't need hospital level of care, but then they're susceptible to everything else that might be in at a hospital. So it's in the best interest of the resident. If they don't need to go to the hospital, let's not send them to the hospital. And that's where we really need your role as medical directors to work specifically with your nursing homes, and hopefully they are contacting you, talking to you about their residents and about, if there's a COVID positive resident, and even pulling in the attending physicians to sit down and say, hey, we don't need to send all these people to the hospital. We're subjecting them to a lot of other possible hospital acquired infections, or just transferring them around. It's hard. Absolutely take it, work with the resident, their family, and they can be transferred to one of our designated facilities. That's why the secretary of our agency is very adamant about, expanding this umbrella that we have for the COVID facilities, so that there's more of them, there's more space available, so facilities don't feel pressured and pressure the medical directors to send folks to the hospitals.
Yeah, Kim, let's stay there, because, and I know, Ian, I'm probably like driving you crazy, jumping around topics, but when looking at the facility staff, you have that medical director who's there to deliver oversight, clinical oversight, make policies, and really should be, and I think all of our opinions who are on this call probably, they should be working hand in hand with the administrator, the director of nursing, and even maybe the corporate leadership if they're in a chain. And then you have the attending physicians, the nurse practitioners, the physician assistants who may be rounding on those facilities and in those facilities. What we saw early, one thing was that some facilities were telling our medical directors and our clinicians that they can't come into the building. And I think you helped us out with that. Where are we at now? Because we still have some of those facilities who are saying that. And what we're finding is that there's inconsistent telehealth measures in those facilities. So where should we be at, and what should we be doing?
Well, and I do remember early on, there were even some large corporations that had a blanket policy not to let the medical director in, which was just quite shocking to us here. To me, that was quite concerning, and even to our secretary, that, of all people, not to let in your medical director. And thank you for saying that has gotten a little better. If you are still, having those barriers, please reach out individually. I don't mind, calling the facility, talking to them about it. But a medical director's role during this time is very critical. I mean, I know they're the requirements, the federal requirements for medical director and the role of the medical director in our nursing homes, those requirements have not been waived by the federal government. So the expectation is that medical director is involved. And I know you have attending physicians, and sometimes the medical director is also the attending physician, but the medical director and even your pharmacy consultant really play a role with a facility specifically that may be struggling with a large number of COVID positive patients. I see the medical director's role too in helping a facility if they want to set up a designated unit. I know in our counties, our county health departments, they have medical directors in their county health departments, and I see our nursing home medical directors working, you know, closely with the county health department medical directors to ensure that we are all on the same page with following CDC recommendations. And I think that maybe early on, we were not having a lot of conversations with the medical directors. And I think that hopefully moving forward, and I do know in some facilities that we have had some struggles in, we have told the facility, you need to bring in your medical director. And your medical director needs to work with the medical director in the county and the medical directors in our, in the chief medical officers in the local hospitals. And if you are continuing to see barriers about a nursing home not letting you in, because I know telehealth is great. I've had a telehealth appointment with my endocrinologist, but there, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work. And especially in maybe some of our rural areas, the emergency order, executive order that the governor put in place, it does not restrict the medical director. As a matter of fact, the medical director should be coming in, you know, even if the medical director doesn't have any patients that, as the attendant, the medical director should be coming in because the medical director is a leader in our nursing homes.
And I thank you for that. We've been asked that question a lot about mm-hmm. what is the role of the medical director, actually over years. And I think we're seeing now what the role of the medical director really is.
Oh, and I can tell you, you know, and you may or may not know this. I mean, we have still seen a high number of immediate jeopardies. And part of our investigation process, if we determine an immediate jeopardy situation, whether it's related to infection control or quality of care, you know, part of our responsibility through our investigation process is to interview the medical director. And so that's why CMS thinks it's very pertinent to the medical for the medical director to be involved. As a matter of fact, you know, I mentioned I had some conversations this morning before this call with CMS and their regional medical director, Dr. Richard Wild. The nursing homes that I had a conversation with, they actually had their medical director on the phone as well. So, you know, CMS does expect medical director involvement.
So, yeah, I think that we are all trying to figure out when we're in those roles or even as the clinicians in the building, how do we, you know, if we wanted to move a person, you know, those intervention points, are the facilities in lockstep with us, or how do we get them in lockstep so that they understand that, yes, we have a positive, but we're going to try to transfer them to one of the dedicated facilities? Like, what is the education maybe through ACA, and what should we be doing on the ground?
Sure. And you know, since the medical director would be boots on the ground, they're working with the facilities. You know, there are a list of our dedicated facilities. And I'll make sure you guys have that list. It's public information posted on our website. As a matter of fact, it's been in several of Governor DeSantis's press conferences. She's had slides up where our dedicated facilities are. I'll make sure to get these to you and you guys can get them out to your organization. They include the number of beds for each one of the facility and the contact information. So if you do have a situation like we'll say in Polk County and you have, you know, a couple of residents that test positive, the nursing home is not able to, you know, isolate those residents, are not able to, you know, have a dedicated wing or unit, and the medical working with the medical director, the nursing home feels like they need to transfer these residents and they don't need hospital level care, they can reach out directly to one of these nursing homes. And like I said, in Polk County, there is Oak Bridge. We're also setting up additional ones in that area. You reach directly out to that admissions coordinator and work out a facility-to-facility transfer. And that's really the best thing to do. And since we're talking about, you know, transfers, and we really don't want to, you know, dump all of our residents into a hospital, I do want to also stress, and maybe you can help get the message out too, is that if a resident does need to go to the hospital, there's got to be some better communication between the nursing home and assisted living facility to the hospital. What a lot of hospitals have complained to us is, well, there may be times that a resident does need a hospital level care. Sometimes the hospital doesn't know those residents are coming, and they are just, their ERs are getting overwhelmed. So communication is very critical during this time. And I know we've always talked about communication, but it is even more critical during this time. So again, just a recap, you can transfer from one nursing home to another nursing home. Into one of our COVID facilities, absolutely. That needs to be communication between that one facility, and maybe even it's that one facility medical director picking up the phone and calling the medical director in a COVID positive facility and saying, hey, I have this resident that I need to transfer over there. You know, can you take the patient? And let's try to keep all these residents out of the nursing home, I mean, out of hospitals as much as possible. If they don't need that hospital level of care, then let's not send them. And I think that's where medical directors could really help us, is talking to their facilities about, you know, when is the appropriate time to transfer to a hospital? When do we need to just to have a direct transfer from the nursing home to one of our dedicated facilities? So that's where we really need the medical directors to help us with these transfers.
So what about when we have, you know, I think there's been a challenge with some of our assisted living facilities where there's a refusal to take back a resident who may have been positive. So in those situations, even if you have someone who's asymptomatic and you're still waiting for those two negative tests, how do we transfer them to from the ALF into a specialized COVID-19 unit?
It would work the same way. We have done a lot of our assisted living facilities, if they've gotten their test results back and the ALF is, you know, maybe they don't have private rooms. Maybe the residents have some memory issues and the ALF is just not able to ensure that they're going to be able to isolate these residents. They can also do a direct transfer to one of our COVID facilities as well. We are looking at bringing on board a couple of ALFs. There is a ALF in Hillsborough County that is dedicated, and it's for ALF residents. It is not one of the agency's designated facilities. It is paid for, those services are paid directly through CARES dollars from Hillsborough County to, and that's University Village in Hillsborough. But they're getting full too. But some of our other designated facilities are able to take the assisted living facilities. What we're having a little bit of issue with is residents from some of the assisted living facilities that have a little bit of more limited mental health, or maybe some behavior issues. They're ambulatory and may just not want to listen to staff to stay in the room or keep their mask on. So that is a little bit of struggle, but I think the individual dedicated facilities have been doing it for a while now, and they've really been able to help a little bit with this. What some of the issues come up is when a resident that was positive that was transferred to one of our COVID designated facilities is when that resident has their two negatives and they're ready to be transferred back to their home, whether it's the ALF or their nursing home. Sometimes we're seeing the nursing home or ALF really not wanting to take those residents back. Now, I will tell you this, and you can share this, I've actually made several phone calls myself directly to those facilities and said, I understand that our nursing home has three of your patients and they have their negative test and they're ready to be transferred back. And it's a little different outcome if I make a phone call. I don't like to make those phone calls, but I will. But I think that that's something that we're seeing, is that some delays in the facilities wanting to, you know, taking their residents back.
So what do you need us to do to get around all of that? Like, so that we are teaching and educating maybe the clinicians, the medical directors, the facilities about how to care for the asymptomatic patients, starting isolation units, all of that. You know, what do you need us to do?
I think just making yourselves available to your facilities that you contract with, and taking the CDC recommendations, because you know there's also some language on CDC's website specific to assisted living facilities, and there's a lot of great information on CDC's website about how to set up a designated unit. And I think that, you know, you, the medical directors helping a facility where it's a nursing home or ALF, walk through how that will work following CDC's recommendations. I think that that's the best, one of the best uses of a medical director. I think that your nursing home should listen to your clinical expertise. They contract with you. So they should listen to your clinical expertise and how you can help them, you know, get through this crisis, because it's not going away tomorrow. I mean, we're going to be in this for a while. As a matter of fact, I think the public health emergency is set to expire in July, but that's going to be extended for another 90 days from the federal government. So it's not going away. And I think that the more that you can be involved with your facilities and help provide that education, especially going back and, you know, helping them understand, you know, the recommendations and guidelines from CDC, because we enforce CDC. We stick by what CDC is saying, you know, what their recommendations are. County health departments also make recommendations. Sometimes those are in line and in step with CDC, sometimes they aren't, but we as regulatory body, we have to go by CDC guidelines. But I think that that medical directors, you know, providing that education and support and just letting the nursing homes, And I know some ALS have medical directors too, just letting them know they're there. I mean, that's why they have a contract with you to be there to help them through these situations.
So Kim, I know you mentioned the memo earlier. We do have a question about the CMS memo that stated that they were gonna get faster testing to the nursing homes. Can you speak about that?
Oh yeah, that was a memo that came out, I think, early May. There's been so many memos come out, I get confused myself. But yeah, and I think that that goes with the press release that came out last night about the point of care testing. We are waiting to get more information on that for residents to be tested. But I think that that goes in line with that memo that came out in May about testing.
Yeah. And I had another question for you, Kim, before we open it up to everyone, maybe two other questions. we've seen a lot of things in the press about nursing facilities who are having outbreaks, may have poor quality, deliver poor care. How are we dispelling those myths and really dismissing that, you know, because I don't, you know, we know it's not valid. We know that outbreaks can occur in any facility.
Outbreaks, doesn't matter if you're a 5-star facility, a 3-star facility, or a 1-star facility. I think we all know, you know, once this virus gets in, it's in, and it's just a matter of how we're going to mitigate it to get rid of it and keep it out. You're right. It's not, you know, if you look at the numbers, just in our nursing homes, I mean, alone, we have over, hang on for just a second, you know, we have 703 nursing homes. And I think out of the 703 nursing homes, you know, 600 and something of those actually have a, you know, a positive case, whether it's one case, 15 cases or 50 residents who are positive. And those vary from 1-star to 5-star facility case, this facility. So I don't know if that really, I think that there's folks have tried to tie it to that, oh, all your 1-star facilities, they're the ones that have the most outbreaks. And that's not really proven true, as you said. I think it's a matter of just how aggressive a facility is with their infection prevention and control, and how aggressive they are staying on top of their staff. And I think that that's one of the critical pieces, as that, you know, as a role of a medical director, is, you know, as we know, our nursing homes and even our AL lives, you know, the use of PPE, while nursing homes used PPE, to use it in this manner and as frequently and the different types of people, I mean, the N95 mask, I remember back when H1N1, and that wasn't every nursing home. Now every nursing home should be prepared and have, you know, fit tested for N95s, and just the volume of PPE and the requirements, and how long have we talked about appropriate hand hygiene, because that is an area that we're still seeing deficient practice in. But I think if you look at, you know, from that perspective, the enhanced infection prevention and control requirements, whether, you know, now some of our five-star facilities, they may have been better, you know, they may have been better prepared. Maybe they had better education that was provided, but now I think everybody's about in the same boat. But I think it's just, we got to stay on top of our staff and, you know, being out on the floors with staff. And I think that's another thing the medical directors could do, is to help provide education on donning and doffing PPE. I mean, we, you know, that's been a struggle. Making sure people are wearing masks appropriately. I mean, I think we see it on TV, people walking around with masks, you know, around their neck. Well, that's not doing you any good. I think, you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think there's been some correlation, and honestly, we had a facility in here in the Panhandle area that has historically been a 4- and 5-star facility. They had some outbreaks. They ended up having an immediate jeopardy related to infection control and a moratorium put on their facility. It's all public record. But, you know, again, they're a 4- and 5-star facility. So it's just just because you have an outbreak doesn't mean that you are a 1- or 2-star facility or have poor quality of care. But thank you for asking that question.
Yeah. If someone wanted to reach out to you after the call and discuss issues or complaints that they may have, could they email you, or is that?
Absolutely. You can email me. That'd be fine. I think my phone's been blowing up off the hook for phone calls. So you can email me, or I know Ian can share my contact information. You can text me as well.
And we had a question about what happens if the situation worsens and we see that both acute and post-acute settings are overwhelmed. What are the alternative plans of care?
As far as, you know, with the hospital surge, mm-hmm. Well, I think that there has been some discussion about, and this was early on, you know, we set up some, you know, kind of some hospital settings, like portable hospital settings down in Miami-Dade. And I think there were plans to set one up in, you know, Orange County area. And I think that those are still there. I mean, those plans are still, you know, something that could be done if we, you know, felt that that was necessary. Some leadership in South Florida has asked for, you remember the ship Mercy that went to New York and was never used? Some leadership in that southern part of our state has asked, well, could that, you know, ship be available? We have a couple of portable ICU units where there are 12 to 14 beds that can be utilized around the state. I think that that's definitely something Governor DeSantis has had conversations with our Department of Emergency Management, Jared Moskowitz, Dr. Rifkes, our Surgeon General, and then Secretary Mary Mayhew as, you know, worst case scenario. And I think that there are plans available if we get to that point. That's why we're trying to keep our nursing home and our ALF residents out of the hospital, because if they don't need hospital level care, then they just don't need to go. And I think that that just is causing a bigger strain on our healthcare system than necessary when they can get their services in the facility or go to one of our designated facilities.
Yeah, we are definitely working as an organization on something to help with that. We did have another question that came in through the chat about that's really focused around residents' mental health and discussions about suicides that we may be seeing amongst residents in the nursing facilities at ALs.
I can tell you early on, and I don't have any statistics, but I can tell you early on that's been part of our conversation with our leadership here is with the visitation rules in place. And I will say we have discussed internally, and I know our secretary has been speaking with the governor's office, is how would visitation look if we relaxed it? So we are going through that exercise of writing out very specifically, if we rolled back visitation, how would that look? I mean, because I am concerned, as I'm sure many of you, with the psychosocial impact and just how this has had such a negative impact on our residents' quality of life in our nursing homes. It saddens me every day when I read complaints that come into our facility about a resident where the daughter says, I have seen my mother just lose weight just through, you know, FaceTime, or I've seen her deteriorate through FaceTime. It's very, you know, that's very sad. And those are complaints that we actually go on site to investigate. But you're right. I mean, I'm sure that there are more statistics coming and more data that we will all see and various, you know, reports of the impact of this prolonged isolation of our residents. So, but that's why we do encourage, you know, I think there was some myths early on about, you know, you couldn't, everybody had to eat in their room and keep their doors shut. You know, it's okay to have, you know, your dining in your dining room, but everybody needs to be social distancing, just like we're doing here. You know, so what we do at my work environment is we social distance or we wear masks. And I think that that's the way that, you know, for until there's a vaccine, I think that that's how we're going to operate it. But I can tell you every day, I think about those residents who are being isolated. And I can tell you that is something that we do look at when we go into these facilities, because as you know, we have ramped up our on-site inspections, specifically in our nursing homes, because of the recent releases of memos from CMS for our increased workload.
Thank you, Kim. Does anyone have any additional questions for Kim?
Do you mind if I say a few things just quickly?
Go ahead, please.
Okay, so I just wanted to mention it, and if you haven't read QSO Memo 2031, I really encourage you as medical directors to read that and understand the implications this memo has on us from a workload perspective so that you know an increase in our on-site activities. Hopefully, facilities are sharing with you their data they're reporting to CDC. CMS is looking at that data and reviewing that data, and facility and reports are being sent to me as a state survey agency director. One of the requirements in there is that we had to complete 100% on-site focused infection control survey in every single nursing home in the state of Florida. Well, we have 703 nursing homes in Florida, and I'm proud to say that from March 9th to July 8th, we finished 100% completing those surveys. Now, many of those facilities we visited more than one time, but we were required to complete those by July 31st, and we met that deadline. Additionally, through the CDC reporting that is mandatory for nursing homes, if there's a 10% increase in cases based on a resident on a facility's census, a 20% or 10 or more deaths through the CDC reporting from one week to the next, then that information is sent to me, and we have to initiate an on-site focus control survey within 30 days of data receipt of that report. What has recently happened is on Friday night, I received another list of we have to initiate within investigations in 3 to 5 days of a facility that had 3 or more new or suspected confirmed cases based on the CDC NHSN data report, or one confirmed resident case in a facility that had previously been COVID-free. And we have to initiate an investigation within those nursing homes within 3 to 5 business days. So I received that report on Friday. there were 90 facilities in Florida on that report. Now, we whittled it down because we had been to some of those. We've been to about 30 of those in the past 2 weeks. So if we'd been to those in the past 2 weeks, we didn't have to go again. So we have about 67 this week that we are doing. We started Monday, so we have until Friday to wrap those up. But I just wanted to let you know the increased survey activity, and you know, you may be asked if when we come in, we may want to talk to the medical director about, you know, your role, or ask some questions of you. But I just wanted to let you know that, and to let you know, and I'm planning on covering this at FLDNA, CMS also has enhanced enforcement activities that we have to do for facilities that are cited for infection prevention and control under F880, whether it's a directed plan or correction, discretionary denial of payment for new admissions, or enhanced civil monetary penalties. And that's all outlined in that QSO memo 2031 that came out June 1st. So I do encourage all medical directors, if you're at home today and you got a little time, pull that memo up and read it. And you may want to spend some time working with your nursing homes about the language in that memo so that they understand of the enhanced enforcements and they understand the increased survey activity. And any facility that's reporting their data, they're probably going to figure out that one more report this that shows an increase in my cases, so I can expect a survey by the Bureau of Field Operations at my local field office. So just wanted to put that plug in there.
Oh, thank you for that. We had another question that came through the chat about if residents are testing negative, why can't they, some of the infection control restrictions be lifted on them so that they can maybe dine together, sit together, such as a family would.
Yeah, and that's fine. Absolutely. You know, there was, you know, all this, like I said, missed earlier about no congregant dining. If they are negative, they're social distancing, wearing masks. We have seen some facilities, have residents that are able to dine in the dining room. Again, maybe instead of four people to a table, they're sitting like one person or two people, as long as there are distances between them. I think the important thing, you know, we've been pushing for employees to make sure they're using good hand hygiene. We got to do the same thing for our residents, making sure they're following good hand hygiene protocols as well.
Perfect. Thank you, Kim. Thank you so much for this hour. It's been wonderful.
Absolutely. I enjoyed it too. It's definitely been a nice break for me to do something a little different than respond to emails and phone calls. So I appreciate the break myself.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.